serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our chat with an incredibly sharp 100-year-old named George Eldridge. Originally from Alma, Kansas, he's lived for almost 50 years now in Nampa, Idaho. But during World War II, he was crammed into the nose of B-26 marauders in the skies over Europe. We heard about one of the missions for which he received the Distinguished Flying Cross, but now we need to hear about how you earned that Purple Heart.
We were chasing those V-1 launch sites called no-balls. I don't know why they called them no-balls, but they were called no-ball sites.
So you had been briefed on where these sites might be, and you're supposed to go find them and drop bombs on them.
Oh, yes. We knew where they were. We just finished the bomb run. We'd gotten some pretty close. A piece of flak had hit my pilot, the aircraft commander, in the chest, but he had the flak suit on, and so he got the piece of flak. And in the process, the plexiglass window was shattered. That's when I got peace in here.
You're describing that like it's no big deal or it's matter of fact, but when you're cramped into the nose of this B-26 and all of a sudden flak comes through that plexiglass and shatters it and goes everywhere, I imagine that's got to be loud. It's got to be chaotic. I mean, what was that moment like?
It doesn't happen. It's just instantly. It's over.
So you see the piece of flak that hit your pilot's flak suit, but you don't realize that something got you in the cheek?
No. A little bit of blood came down, and Carl says, "Hey, you've got a piece of flak on your face." And he reached over and pulled it out, and it was just a little sliver. Uh-huh. And I said, "Just hold on. You've got one," and it had pinned his eyelid down like this, that close to his eye. I pulled it out of his cheek right here.
And I'm thinking, how could you not feel that? Is it the cold of the altitude? Is it the adrenaline?
All three.
So you guys pull flak out of each other's faces and then put each other in for Purple Hearts or what?
That's up to the flight surgeon to do that.
They did give you a Purple Heart for that. They also gave you the Distinguished Flying Cross more than once. Any other close calls you think we should know about?
There were always times... when a flak gets, and you see one or two go down, you wonder about it.
That's not just a plane. Those are your buddies.
They're all in the whole airplane will go down. When the airplane gets hit in the engine and blows up, it pretty well, the whole airplane blows up because the tank probably goes off too. And it's just like that. They're there and they're gone the next and it's way behind you.
But doesn't that tell you that you could be next?
No. You don't think that way.
What would you say was the hardest part or the most challenging aspect of flying all those missions in B-26s?
Probably the one when we went over to Rouen on the Rhine River and did nothing because one of the airplanes on the way back went down and only one man bailed out of it.
And you shared kind of how you got desensitized to the danger aspect or, you know, your own personal vulnerability. But how hard was it to deal with losing guys that you'd trained with or that you'd flown with or that, you know, you were around?
You just have to pack up their things, all of their belongings, and write letters to their family. The squadron commander has to do it, and all the crew members also had to do it if it was your crew member. And then in the case of many of your friends, you helped send letters back to the family.
That's something you had to do personally?
Oh, yes. And it had to have been handwritten. They couldn't be typed. I was in Belgium, but the squadron commander had left some things when we moved from England over to Belgium. He made arrangements that somebody would pick him up. And he said, because I was so close to coming home, and the war was just so close to over, he said, "You're going to pick up this stuff, and you got a C-47. And we were back at Stansted, so naturally I went to London. I was there in May of 45. You can't imagine how many glasses were broken and thrown out on the streets. Glass on the streets was just solid. I don't know how anybody walked on there. Nobody was barefoot, I'll tell you that. GIs with their girlfriends, or with any girl they could find, hanging out of every window on both sides of the streets all across London. And the British soldiers and airmen, they really got drunk.
Did you get to come home right after that, or were you stuck there for a while?
I came home in September.
You probably had a choice. Get out of the Army Air Corps or stay in?
At the time, I was squadron bombardier, and we had transitioned over to a new night bombing system called Shoran. There were only three or four of us, and we were to go down the southern route through India and up there, but we were to get Douglas B-26s. They'd call them A-26s. I had been flying Shoran missions over eastern France and got pretty good with that thing. It was very accurate.
How did it work?
It had two ground stations, a ground station here and a ground station here. Just how it worked, I don't really remember the details of it, but the two ground stations would put out a signal, and we were using an oscilloscope. We didn't use a radar. Just you know what an oscilloscope is?
Yeah.
A circular.
So the signals coming from those two ground stations allow you to triangulate the target.
It worked real good. I could bomb quite accurate, and I had dropped quite a few bombs over in eastern France with it. Then another story off of it. Come the Korean War, I'm an instructor at Mather Air Force Base, and I get a phone call and then a message from Air Force headquarters that I'm directed to reinstitute a Shoran training program at Mather Air Force Base. The equipment was in storage, and I would install it so that we could have practice bombing into Beale. That's where the SR-71 flies now. We were to train out of Beale, and I set that whole program up before the Korean War got started, and we trained many crews at Mather to fly Shoran.
And then they used it in Korea?
Oh, yes.
And you stayed in for a long time after that. 1969, you finally retired as a full colonel. What were some of the other highlights of your Air Force career?
I flew B-47s back and forth to England for 5 years.
During the Cold War?
Yeah.
See, here's one thing. We talk so much about what happened, what actually took place. We spend very little time talking about what could have happened or what almost happened. I imagine those years in the Cold War, if you're flying those stratajets, there was probably some tension there of, boy, this could get really ugly real fast.
It could, but I never was in anything. I had some friends flying B-47s out of Topeka, Kansas. I flew them out of Salina, Kansas. This one tells me a story. He's one of the airplanes that is an electronic countermeasure snooper. It goes in and catches the frequency and of all the civilians, the Russians, all their radars, and records them, then plots their location. He was a co-pilot in the back seat. That he's out north of Murmansk, out in the international waters. He looks around. He's a co-pilot. It's a MiG, and it comes up and sits on his wingtip, pulls off his head and puts it back on. Get on ears. And so they go on an international frequency. Definitely English-sounding voice says, "What are you doing, Yank?" And "We're over 12 miles off. What can I do for you?" And he says, "I tell you what you can do for me. I can't get a Seiko watch in my exchange. Would you buy me a Seiko watch? Would you send it to me?" "Well, sure. What's your address?" And he gave it to him. When he gets down home, he goes down and buys a Seiko watch and sends it to this address. And he gets a check back, and that's a good check.
How about that? I mean, the Cold War is maybe the most tense time in world history, being carried out by politicians and generals, but those guys who are wing-to-wing in the skies had a mutual respect for each other, it sounds like.
Oh, yes, definitely. The same thing with the Germans. Sure. Oh, yeah. A
couple other things that come to mind. You mentioned, you know, you're in pilot training in King City, and you're Ryan when the Volti-Vibrator comes up and drops you with prop wash and you get washed out. But that wasn't the end of your piloting dreams. How long ago did you become a licensed pilot?
46. I bought a Taylorcraft. I was stationed in Washington, D.C., worked in the Pentagon. I flew it all over the country. A Taylorcraft is, do you know what it is? A little 65-horse engine. It'll cruise 90. A good airplane, really.
Kind of like riding a motorcycle in the sky, right?
Right. Then I traded it for a Swift.
One other thing comes to mind. You have five children, and a lot of grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Am I guessing that you met your wife because of the Air Force?
Oh, she was a nurse at Mather Air Force Base.
Guess it's a good thing you're in the Air Force. Did you ever plan on living to 100?
I don't think anybody does. What is the alternate?
Exactly. Well, what was it like for your 100th birthday to have so many family and friends join you at the Warhawk Air Museum here in Nampa and have that big celebration?
You should have been there.
I'm sorry, I didn't get an invitation.
Some of them, one of them, for instance, I hadn't seen in 4 or 5 or maybe more years. He starts telling about the time that he and I flew an airplane back from down in Reno and things like that.
And when's the last time you piloted an airplane?
Maybe a year ago, or I went up with a fellow in Caldwell. He was going up and wanted to fly instruments, and when you fly instruments, you've got to have somebody in the left seat, make sure you don't run into something else.
So you were 99 years old and piloting an airplane?
Probably.
You know any other 99-year-olds who've done that?
I'm sure there are.
How many airplanes have you personally built with your hands?
Say 3. You want to see a picture of one?
I'd love to, and I understand you're working on number 4?
Oh, yes.
When's it going to be done?
What are you doing next week?
With regard to World War II, you're one of 16 million Americans who were wearing uniforms. Your brother was another one of them. 406,000 Americans died, and some of those were your friends. What do you think those of us today who weren't alive then, what do we need to know and remember about World War II and what all you guys did?
There's so many things I could tell you, but the first thing I'd say is just keep your head. Kids say stay cool. Of all things, stay away from drugs. And alcohol isn't going to do you any good either. I have known so many people with such brilliant opportunities or abilities that have foolishly exploited themselves. That's all you're doing. You can do all the crazy things I did, riding rodeo horses, racing motorcycles and all that, but that won't damage you near as much as a weekend of drugs. I don't know anything about drugs other than to stay away.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story. Is there something that you would say that you're most proud of as you look back now at 100 years?
I'd say I resisted all those.
That you lived a clean life?
Not that I've been exactly clean, but but I resisted narcotics and all that stuff.
Anything else you think we should know?
Other than when's lunch and who's buying.
All right. Fair enough. That sense of humor has been honed for a century now. And hey, maybe if you're in Nampa, Idaho sometime, you can treat George Eldridge to lunch. Or better yet, meet up with him at the Warhawk Air Museum. That's our program for today. Find photos of Mr. Eldridge at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.